Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the largest segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, counterproductive, and cannot be fixed. Our number, if you'd like to engage in this discussion, 877-300-7645. It was another bad day for the NFL. Scott, your favorite player, perhaps. I perhaps shouldn't say that, but certainly your favorite team lost its best player on an indictment based on child endangerment. I'm sure there's a better term for it than of what he was accused of, but Adrian Peterson was sent his son for a visit. I think the son is 4 years old. And his wife are either estranged or divorced. And while he was there, he whipped him some 17 times with a switch, which is a branch from a tree, and whipped him on his bare bottom and legs, creating lasting welts.
Yep. Yeah.
And when he was sent back, he sent him back with the two emails to his mother, and those two emails, Adrian Peterson admitted that he went too far, and that the mom was not going to be pleased. And the mom did take the son to the pediatrician. The son told a horrible story to the pediatrician. The pediatrician looked at the wounds and called the police.
Yep, the text was, you're gonna be mad at me about his leg. I'm kind of good with the tail end of the switch. He told her, I felt bad after the fact when I noticed that the switch was wrapping around and hitting him in the inner thigh. And, he says he got him in the scrotum once, and he felt so bad that he was, well, he said, I'm tearing that butt up when needed. He said, I'm going to start putting him in timeout and save the whooping for needed memories. So,
You've been whipped with a switch?
All right, let me...
Let me just ask you a question. Your father ever whipped you with a switch?
I've never been hit with a switch. I got hit with a belt. In the north, switches aren't really big around in the north, but the belt, I've been hit with the belt, and,
I've been hit with a switch.
Okay.
I can tell you, though, that with my children, I did engage in very, very infrequent corporal punishment, it was always the open palm of my hand on a clothed bottom. Yep. And it would be, and I'm not sure if it was ever more than one swat with an open hand to the bare bottom. I'll have to tell you, though, the reason that I have to say that it was extraordinarily infrequent is that the last time I did it, in fact, every time I did it was always because, mom was about ready to pull out her hair and said, the kids are just not minding me at all. And part of it was my wife had this tendency to threaten things with the children that she was in no position to follow through on, and they knew it. You know, I'm going to send you to boarding school. Yeah, they knew they weren't considered a boarding school. You know, I'm going to, do this, that, and the other thing, and take all the toys away in your room. And they knew she was going to do that. So they knew she was never going to follow through. So it was always my job, and she thought that my job should be to give them a paddle. And so it was more for my wife's benefit than it was for the children. But one swat on the behind, clothed behind, typically diapered behind. When they were between or just shy of two, and then after two, of course, then just on a clothed behind. And then the last time, though, was my eldest son had gone off, and he had cold-cocked his brother. My oldest, loved the fact that he was the only child there for a short while, and had 100% of mom's and dad's attention. So when the brother came along, although they're great friends now, the brother took time away from his exclusive domain with mom and dad. And so occasionally he would smack his brother. So I saw him do that, and I gave him a smack on the bottom and said, "You cannot hit your brother. That's wrong. Hitting is wrong."
And that's what happened.
And he turned to me and said, "Then why did you hit me?"
Yep.
And at that point, that was my last paddle on the behind. At that point, he was like 2.5 years old, and I said, "Okay, not going to do that again."
Me, I have been. I was originally, when I was spanked, when I was a kid, I'd get spanked by my dad, and eventually the spanking didn't work because, you know, usually when you spank a kid, he cries, and I didn't cry. I just looked at him, I said, "Is that the best you can do?" And then he, you know, so I antagonized him, and then he started hitting me with the belt, and I'd always get hit with the belt on the bare butt. And eventually that didn't work. And but by then it didn't really matter anymore. And I don't look back on any of that stuff.
Yeah. My dad actually hit me with a branch, with a switch, and as hard as he could. And he did inflict wounds. And it was one of many things that caused me to dislike, I don't want to use a word stronger than that at the moment, but to dislike my father.
Well, here's my thing, is times have changed. I'm not afraid to spank Neil, but I haven't. I never have. I've known Neil since he was 2 years old. I've never spanked him. Kids today, I didn't have all the stuff Neil has today. I didn't have, you know, tablets and computers and things like that when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
instant
with Neil,
access to the world.
Yeah. So with Neil, if I take away his tablet, that's world-crushing to him. If I tell him he can't go out and play with his friends, that's world-crushing to him. And then I explain why he can't do that stuff, and he usually changes his attitude and stuff like that. I've never felt the need to hit a kid. But I don't look back on anything my dad did with me, and I don't look back on it and think that it was bad, because it made me who I am. And it's how I go about things now. I'm not somebody that thinks that I need to impose physical force on anybody, especially somebody that is so much smaller than me.
You're 6'4", 225 pounds.
230 pounds, yeah.
Yeah, so you're, as a guy your size, you have to be careful. That's like the whole NFL scenario, is that you're not talking about wimpy guys. These are big, strong guys, when a person is well over 6 feet and carries that weight and is in shape, then, you know, they don't have to be carrying a knife or a gun to be lethal. I mean, you're a big guy. You can hurt a kid.
The only time that I've ever done anything physical towards Neil is, who is my girlfriend's son. He's not my kid, but he calls me dad, and it's something that I like very much. Mm-hmm. The only time that I've ever used any sort of physicality with Neil is when he was going to hit his mom. And he didn't know that I was right there behind him. And he cocked back his fist, and he made a fist, and I grabbed him and I picked him up. And he knows that, you know, when he's wrestling with dad, that he can do things and muscle and, you know, throw me around on the bed and stuff like that.
He can't take a fist to your face, but he can wrestle with you.
Well, yeah, he wrestles with me, and when he's wrestling, you know, you do that thing, "Oh, you're twisting my arm, you're twisting my arm." And this was the first time in Neil's life that he realized that, you know, dad isn't somebody that I can actually muscle around, because I grabbed him and I pulled him away from his mom and I said, you know, "Hey, you don't do that." And he kept trying to push my arm off of him, and he couldn't. But he's never once since that day, anytime that he starts to get mad, and that's the other thing, when he gets upset and he does stuff, I tell him, "Come talk to me." You know, he's a kid. He doesn't know.
Knock it out.
He doesn't understand everything.
Moms aren't perfect, but even imperfect moms don't deserve to be hit.
Well, and he doesn't. He's a kid. A lot of things that they're feeling for the first time. And so, you know, so when I, the Peterson, back to the Peterson thing.
Yes.
When I heard it, it kind of, I understand that everybody learns certain ways, and that I just think it's foolish to be caught up in what your parents did, and use that as an excuse.
Which is what he did. Well, I'm not sure that's what he did.
Well,
his lawyer did. The statement was from his lawyer.
Yeah. Well, no, and he made that statement too. You know, I got whoopings the same way when I was a kid, and he said that to them when they were doing their investigation. And just because your parents did it doesn't mean you have to do it. And
my parents did it, and I didn't do it.
Well, that's just it. And at some point in time, you got to be. You can't say that your parents are the reason you're a certain way. At some point in time, you have to say that, you know, I've made some choices here.
Right.
And it's
and you
choice.
Can achieve an objective in multiple different ways. I mean, when my father beat me with a switch, my father was just mean. And so I had no respect for him. But I give you another example. I was in a fraternity back in the time where hazing was not condoned, but it wasn't strictly illegal. And I was in a pledge class of 18 guys in a fraternity of about 120 at USC. And the actives in the house beat the tar out of the pledges. I mean, we were sleep deprived for seven days. We probably got an average of 30 minutes sleep for 7 days. We were eating things like ivy. We had all sorts of things, spices that were put in the and what little food we got that just made it burn everything. And, you know, no showers and then intense physical exercise. Physical exercise to the point of complete exhaustion. We had three All-American athletes in our pledge class, and everybody played varsity sports in high school in this pledge class. Half the pledge class was student body president in their high school. Strong guys. And yet, every single one of them collapsed. I was the only one at the end that didn't break, and they kept on, they're going to keep on Hell Week until everybody broke. And I want to tell you, there was a bonding experience going through that much abuse. But it also created a resentment. And once I went through it, I would never participate in it. I wouldn't perpetuate it because there was a better way to create bonding than physical abuse. But that's how, you know, the SEAL training works, how special forces training works. You just push people over a period of time until they break. And then you try to put them back together the way that you want to have them think. And in my view, while effective, it's a very poor way to condition people. So I would agree with you. Just because your parents did it and achieved the objective with you doesn't mean that it's the right approach with our children. There are always multiple ways to achieve the objective, and beating is seldom the best choice. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we get Scott's concluding comments on Adrian Peterson, one of the things I do want to share is how this fits into the greater context of the things that we talk about on this program. The United States is quick to turn to the switch. We are a very violent country. The Islamic State does things we don't like, and so we send in bombs and we declare war. What we're unwilling to do is to use our words. Words are very powerful tools. Behavior modification, particularly positive rewards, are very, very powerful ways to elicit not only proper behavior, but also sound relationships. There are very few circumstances where physical assaults achieve a beneficial result. And I think that the Adrian Peterson approach, my father's approach to me, was wrong. It is counterproductive. The old adage, spare the rod, spoil the child, is absolutely wrong. It's a lame, violent, knee-jerk, uneducated, and often immoral way to deal with the child rearing. So with that said, Scott, what do you think? And then we're going to get Glenn's comments.
Well, I think a lot of this is being, obviously, this is a big issue right now because, or it's made into a much bigger issue because of the Ray Rice thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's going to get a much harsher penalty.
Right.
Obviously, he knows he did wrong. And he knows that there has to be a consequence for what he did.
But it's a good rule of thumb. Don't strike a woman. If you're a guy, don't strike a child. I mean, it's a good rule of thumb. You just use those and think, you know, there's better ways to resolve disputes. No. And by the way, if you're a woman and you're dating a guy that is an NFL player who is much stronger than you are, don't scratch his face. Don't spit at him. Don't antagonize him.
Don't antagonize him. I actually, whatever happens here, I'll let the legal system do what they want. But when I think about it, if I'm 100% honest with myself, and I look at it, in all the stories that are coming out, he referenced, how he had a good Catholic upbringing, all this other stuff. And
is there such thing? Is a good Catholic
that's
anything?
That's just it. So therefore,
Catholics are abusive.
When I started looking at
pedophiles,
when I looked at the situation, and he said stuff like that, I thought to myself, well, there's the real abuse right there.
Sure. Yeah.
You're putting.
Everybody has abused him with Catholicism.
Well, they abuse him, and then he's doing it to his kids. And I was like, that's your biggest abuse.
The
Everything
second
else,
statement that was cut into the first of the two tablets say that fathers corrupt their children through the third and fourth generation. We're witnessing it with Adrian Peterson.
So after I looked at it, when I looked at it like that, I stopped caring. I stopped caring about it. I didn't care anymore.
Yeah. I stopped watching the NFL. I just, I normally watch the NFL this weekend. It didn't hold any interest to me.
Yeah.
Glenn, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm looking here at Proverbs where King Shlomo or whoever the author was says, withhold not discipline from the child, for if you strike and punish him with a rod, he will not die. Thus I beat him with a rod and shall deliver his soul from hell.
Yeah. I think that was Solomon, wasn't it?
Proverbs 23:13-14.
Yeah, I think it's Solomon. I have chosen, based upon my personal test, to eliminate everything Solomon wrote. I don't include as inspired the Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, or the Psalms that Solomon wrote. Solomon was a spoiled brat. Solomon was, you read Ecclesiastes, it's revolting. Almost everything that Solomon wrote is counterproductive and is inconsistent.
It sounds like someone depressed. Like someone in a serious depression.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, everything is vain. And no matter how you translate vain, failed or egotistical, it's wallowing in heartache. And I mean, there was one time in my life when my whole world was collapsing around me that I found Ecclesiastes not uplifting, but certainly there was a sympathetic voice, but that's not what I needed. And, since I've been part of the covenant with Yahweh, I experience enthusiasm. I experience what we were talking about is positive reinforcements and smiles and parties and... Oh, no, so I think that is a Solomon writing, and I've just chosen to discard it all because it's inconsistent with Yahweh's nature. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So what do you think, Glenn? Would you agree with me that Proverbs 13 was likely scribed by Solomon?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've often thought anyone who's been served divorce papers or had to file bankruptcy should not turn to Ecclesiastes for inspiration from Yahweh.
Oh, no.
That sounds like it was written by Friedrich Nietzsche.
Exactly. It's in fact, you just read through this, and it's just not consistent with the other Proverbs. Most of the Proverbs are a father talking to his son. It's our Heavenly Father speaking to us, and they include the mother's inspiration, too, and usually it's a father and mother to their son, so it's talking about life in the covenant. But this one is a wise son. The fact is that as children, we get wisdom from our father, not the other way around. For those that may be uncomfortable with somebody saying, I choose not to accept it as inspired, what I would encourage you to do is to read Devarim, which is Deuteronomy, both 8 and 13. In fact, read all of Devarim, Deuteronomy, it'll do you good. And recognize that Moshe, speaking to the children of Yisrael, and Yisrael means individuals who engage and endure with God, would include all of us who are part of the covenant family. Moshe tells us specifically what tools that we should use if we wonder whether or not something was inspired. I mean, simply to say that because a bunch of religious people voted to include something in a book doesn't make it inspired. We individually are given the means to determine whether or not it is from Yahweh. And there is a test in both Devarim 8 and 1 and Devarim 13, because this is really important stuff for us to determine whether or not something is from Yahweh. It has to be consistent with his testimony. It has to predict the future and to be accurate in all of its prophetic statements. And it has to be consistent with Yahweh's testimony. And so when I hear something that is not, like Ecclesiastes or the Song of Solomon, I immediately toss it aside and just say, nah.
Yeah. I always found it very, you know, I always noted that you're very careful, in endorsing, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. But right. Typically include the rest of the Tanakh,
right.
which I've wondered. So, and it's interesting because, in terms, I think you just basically gave your rationale
right.
for determining inspiration of writings, and in other words, so like in church circles, of course, the question is always of canonicity is something.
Right.
Part of the, were we talking plenary verbal inspiration of canon and all that
right.
stuff? That's
yeah.
out, totally
yeah.
out the door
right.
for you.
Right, completely. Yes. What it was canonized means, in fact, it's counterproductive from my point of view. That means that religious individuals that I would not only have no respect for, but I would be vehemently opposed to, voted that this was consistent with their religious perspective, and therefore I will reject out of hand what they support. There is no testimony in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that says accept that which religious authorities accept. Never. So I would discard that out of hand. And a great example is the Christian Bibles all include a New Testament when there can't be a New Testament. The covenant has not yet been renewed. And half of the Christian New Testament was written by a man who admitted he was demon-possessed, Paul. And all of what he wrote has to be discarded. So, yeah, there's a wholesale cleansing necessary if you're going to determine what you can trust and what you can't.
Right, and apparently, even in something like the Proverbs, you're judging each one separately, individually.
I am. I would do the same thing with the Psalms. Although I don't recall any Psalm that I have come across that doesn't seem to be inspired, and the vast preponderance of the Proverbs are consistent with Yahweh's testimony and therefore inspired. And there are writings, for example, the writings of Shemuel, Samuel. Most of what's there appears to be accurate historically as well as accurate prophetically. And if it's accurate historically, accurate prophetically, consistent with Yahweh's overall nature, recognizing it can still have things in it that aren't consistent with Yahweh. And it can be
right.
His testimony. And what I mean by that is that Yahweh is, in many of these stories that he tells, he gives the person's response and dialogue. For example, when Yahweh sent the messengers to Sodom, and they encountered Lot, And Lot's response was, you know, you guys are really good looking, and so the people here are going to want to rape you. And when the locals and Sodom came to his door, he says, you know, don't, you can't have the cute little boys that were all aglow as divine messengers, but you can have my virgin daughters. Now, Yahweh is not telling us that we should sacrifice our virgin daughters to be raped. This is, but to be an accurate rendition of what occurred, it's got to have Lot's response, no matter how inappropriate it may have been. And, first of all, the daughters were not offered they were offered, but not taken. And second of all, when you look at it, there's actually a very important message that's conveyed by Lot's stupidity. And that is that, you know, Yahweh was having that whole conversation with Abraham on Sodom and how bad the place was. And Abraham's trying to negotiate with Yahweh and say, you know, how many righteous people have to be there to spare the place? And it turns out there was only one righteous person from Yahweh's point of view. And that dude wasn't very righteous. Which tells us that Lot's righteousness from Yahweh's perspective had to be related to one of two things. Either as a relative of Abraham, he was included by Yahweh into the covenant because Yahweh loved Abraham and wanted Abraham to be as happy as he could be, and therefore including his nephew was seen as the Yahweh's mercy to Abraham. Abraham explained the covenant to Lot, which is more likely, and Lot endorsed the covenant, didn't change the fact that it didn't make him a perfect person from a worldly behavior point of view, look at David, but it made him look perfect in Yahweh's eyes. And then Lot's family would have been brought along because Lot was in the covenant. And so it tells us that flawed individuals, guys like me, can be included in God's family because, you know, the covenant is not for perfect people.
Right. This is a bit of a side. You might want to address it another. Well, first of all, I was going to say with Lot, it sounds like it's the latter. He sounds like he had some sort of essential rudimentary commitment to covenant with Yahweh.
Yes, he does.
You know, I suppose it's just being for Abraham's sake. Since we're addressing canonicity inspiration issues there, and you might have addressed this previously, maybe could sometime in the future, maybe address some of the issues that come up with Deuteronomy, and its origins. Because I know there's sometimes controversy over the origins of Deuteronomy, or at least
I'm only in that that there are a lot of folks that think there were four authors of J and P and Y and the like for the Torah because there's portions of the Torah that speak in a different voice. You know, there's Yahweh's voice. Personally, I think that's a bunch of scholarly baloney.
The two guys who popularized that stuff.
What's really sad is that although there is no proof, there is, because scholastic notions like this are taught in school, they're accepted as true by other scholars, even though there's no evidence.
So we parrot. We're parrots all too often.
Right.
You know,
right.
I look back at how many times I've played the parrot.
Right.
It's like,
yeah, no. Yeah, no, I will tell you, there is a measured difference between Devarim and the first four books of the Torah. And in Devarim, it's Moshe speaking in first person. I think it's a really ingenious approach. What Yahweh in Bereshith, Genesis, and in Shemoth, which means names, Exodus, and in Kara, which means invitation to be called out and meet, Leviticus, laid out his nature, introduced himself to us, explained the whole creation process, explained the nature and purpose of the covenant, and then lays out the path from our world to eternity in his home. It's a beautiful presentation of all of those kinds of things with Yahweh speaking in first person to us about these the most important things in the universe. What Dabarim does, words, which has been corrupted to Deuteronomy, which means the second law. It's a horrible name for a wonderful book, is that Moshe, after listening to everything that Yahweh had to say, after writing down everything Yahweh had to say, after having the opportunity to interact as a mediator to some extent and a teacher between Yahweh and the children of Israel, to say, all right, this is what God said. This is what it's related to. This is what it means. This is how it applies in your life. This is what's most important for you to understand and embrace. I think that that kind of summary in a human voice that is someone who has spent quality time with Yahweh, been inspired by Yahweh, someone who loves Yahweh's teaching, I think that kind of approach to summarize it all is extraordinarily helpful. It's sort of like the 119th Psalm where Dode does a very similar thing for us. So I actually like the voice of Dabarim. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Miz. I do want to share one thing with you, Glenn, on my perspective on Dabarim, and it's grown, developed, evolved over time, is that had the Torah simply been Moshe taking dictation from Yahweh, with the exception of the fact that, of course, the book of names, Shemot, has Yahweh appearing to Moshe, introducing himself by name to Moshe, asking Moshe to go with him on this mission to free his children, and has Moshe involved in all of that process, and therefore, you know, he is a participant. He's not so much a participant in the message without Dabarim. And Dabarim, what it shows is that Moshe engaged with Yahweh, came to know him, took this long journey with him, relied upon him, trusted him, accomplished a great undertaking with him. And then after scribing the Torah on behalf of Yahweh, shared how that Torah can be integrated into our lives. What's the most important aspects of the Torah teaching, and how to make them relevant within your life. For example, both accounts as to how to determine whether or not something was inspired by Yahweh and therefore embrace it, learn from it, or not inspired by Yahweh and therefore absolutely reject it, are based upon Moshe's statements in Dabarim. And so I think what it does is it elevates Moshe's value. And I like that because Yahweh's nature is that he could have, and at one time did, do everything himself. You know, he bellowed out the Torah, you know, in front of everybody. Everybody could hear. And folks didn't like it very much. God, way too intimidating. He didn't mean to be, but that's, you know, he's God. And so it's Yah's nature to engage and to work through his creation, to actually partner with us in not only the conveyance of his message, but also in sharing the benefit of engaging in a relationship with him. So I really like that a flawed, imperfect individual is sharing what he learned, sharing his thoughts with us in Dabarim. I think it makes it the whole communication much more valuable, interesting.
Right, that's right.
That's my thoughts.
That makes sense. I'm thinking that they may have presumed to name it Deuteronomy because it's the book in which the ten instructions are reiterated.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Many things are reiterated. It's a reiteration also of the seven invitations to meet with Yahweh. So
right.
There are a number of things that are reiterated, but there is no form of teaching that I'm aware of that is effective if you say something only once.
Well, that's why we need repetition. I mean, that's why you have to practice the piano.
Right. That's right. No, that's why Yada Yah is a 2,500-page book. Yahweh communicated important truths to us from many different perspectives at many different times through many different individuals, all of which helps us solidify and our understanding, conclusions that we can trust because they are consistently reaffirmed. It's a powerful tool. I want to share a letter, Glenn, about that I received just moments ago. I've scanned it. I haven't really thought about it, but I want to share this letter. It is one that, and we're going to go into the next segment with it. It's gut-wrenching. The person who wrote the letter is someone that I come to know through the Yada Yah sites and forum. I've never met him personally, and I'm going to leave his name as anonymous. Yada. My dad used a rubber hose and a 2x4 on my older brother. He knocked me out twice after I was 15, thinking that I deserved it. My older brother was shot by my Christian mom at the age of 17 and is paralyzed today from tripping on LSD and coming at her with a butcher knife in the 60s. I'm going to share more of this letter, and I want people to think about the fact that the violent approach is almost always inferior to using our words.